Welcome to the InternetCases.com podcast. I'm attorney Evan Brown. Today I'm pleased to bring you the audio from a panel discussion held on November 29, 2005 at the John Marshall Law School in Chicago. The topic of the discussion was Google Book Search. Professor Doris Long moderated the talk. After her introduction, the audience heard from Professor Leslie Reese, who discussed issues relating to the Google Book Search business model. Next, adjunct professor and attorney Todd Fleming addressed the technology behind Google Book Search. Then, I covered some of the legal issues in the cases brought against Google Book Search by the authors Guild and the American Association of Publishers. I focused specifically on the fair use factors that are set forth in Section 107 of the Copyright Act and the Ninth Circuit decision of Kelly v. Arribasoft. Following me was Professor David Sorkin, who compared the search technologies and the consequences thereof for both Google Book Search and normal web searches. The final speaker on the panel was Tom Keefe of the John Marshall Law School Library. He discussed a librarian's perspective on how Google Book Search can affect the way research is done. Here now is the audio from the program.
What I want to do today is look at the entire issue about Google Library, Bookprint, and even beyond that, business model questions, privacy questions that are raised by this idea of taking something in the hard goods world and moving it into the private one. Just a couple of quick flags. Wired November issue covered it. There have been two lawsuits that have been filed in the Southern District of New York, one a class action complaint about the Google Library project, the other one filed by various publishing companies. It is definitely a hot topic, and as we've got this up and going, I am going to get out of the way and let our moderators take off, and they already know their order.
Well, we sort of duked it out.
They know their time limit, and I will get out of the way and let Professor Reese start.
Well, thank you, Professor Long. Adjunct Professor Todd Fleming is going to talk to you a little bit about the technology, but before we get there, there are a few issues involving the business implications that I'd like to raise with you, and I want to start off the discussion with two recent headlines, both of these within the last 2 weeks, one from the Baltimore Sun. The headline is Copyrights and Wrongs, Google versus the Publishers. And the first sentence or two of the article is, barring last-minute developments, the coming weeks will see the resumption of a technological revolution that many authors and publishers are arguing is the biggest threat to their industry since Beaver Cleaver supplanted the Hardy Boys. Google's project to digitize the contents of five major libraries and make it possible to search for books online, and obviously they didn't get the Hardy Boys reference. That's probably only valid for our age. Oh well. The second headline, dated us again. The second headline is from Internet Daily, and the headline is Publishers Google War Could Be Bigger Than Grokster. And the first line from the article is, publishing industry resistance to a Google plan to put all the world's literary works online under a fair use claim could become the most interesting and potentially the most disruptive copyright fight in many decades. The two suits dwarf the MGM versus Grokster file sharing controversy. Before we really get into the meat of this particular controversy, I want you to remember that practically every act done on the internet involves some form of copying. Whether that is accessing a website, using a search engine, conducting internet transactions, virtually everything you do on the internet involves copying. Search engines are no exception, and Professor Fleming is going to talk to you a little bit about how they work, what the technology is involved, and how search engines in and of themselves are actually making copies of work as they do what they do. So if you keep that in mind, and keep in mind the notion that most websites, like most authors of books, want their works to be read. Most website operators want their sites to be found. Most authors want their books to be read. So if you think about the activities that you do on the internet all the time and how in some way or another copying without the explicit permission of the creator of either the website or the content provider on the website, other than the fact that most operators put their stuff out on the internet because they want you to visit the sites, they want you to see it, copying is occurring. So one question to ask is sort of a foundational issue with all of this is, does everything you do on the internet, does accessing every single website you visit, do all acts on the internet actually result in a copyright violation or a fair use? Or if you see fair use as a defense, and Professor Long and I will argue about that at some future point in time, is it an acceptable, an excusable violation of copyright? Anything you do on the internet. So start there as a baseline as we sort of work through the rest of the conversation. And if you think about how you use the internet and therefore perform copying on a regular basis, you need to look at how that form of copying, making copies, that form of copying has created a whole new way of communication and a whole array of new businesses, new ways of doing businesses, new business models. Everything from how you buy stuff to how you do online research. So there are all of these new ways of doing business that have emerged because of the technology. And we've seen how a lot of emerging technologies have really wreaked havoc on traditional or long-established business models. And very often, those who make money by utilizing those business models are very resistant of the technologies, or in some cases have tried to stifle either the production, the development, or the use of those technologies altogether. We've certainly seen that in the RIA approach to peer-to-peer. So you need to look at how traditional businesses view this new sort of competitive model that comes into the stream. And very often, the resistance by the sort of old school folks is unsuccessful. The result of all of it is the creation of new business models and new businesses that emerge from the ashes of old business. And we've seen that again in areas like home video technology, where the fear came from primarily the television industry, but it spurred an entire new industry, movie rentals. We've seen all sorts of for-profit music downloading services emerge from the wake of all of the peer-to-peer cases. So we see new developments, and what do we have here? Google comes up with a technology and a methodology that allows for easy searching and indexing of literary works. In Google's own words, Google Print is like an electronic card catalog. It indexes book content to help users find and perhaps buy books. Google sees its entire book project as a tool, and again, its own media. It will make the full text of the world's books searchable by anyone. And neither full text copies in the index nor the few sentences displayed in response to user inquiries will ever displace the original books. So if the idea is not to supplant the original book, what's the point? What do we have going on here in terms of the business model? Is it a marketing tool? Is it a way to steer potential buyers to affiliates like Amazon.com? Maybe. Is it a way to display advertisements from companies that pay Google for that service? Well, maybe. Is it a way to compete with existing indexing services? Is it a way to compete with other for-profit products like Bartlett's Familiar Quotations? Is it a way to provide full-text books online to compete with all of the various other entities that are trying to push the notion of e-books? Or is it really fostering an array of new services that may or may not compete with existing services that do things like search and identify instances of plagiarism or new forms or methodologies for research, both of which seem to be very attractive to us on the academic side, and would certainly be a benefit. And again, creating an absolutely new business model that has nothing to do with the selling of original books. Many claim the technology will revolutionize the publishing industry, and others claim that when the dust clears, this technology, this methodology, will have virtually no effect on the publishing industry, that it won't enhance or impede book sales, and it's actually sort of pie in the sky in that in some of the literature I read, there are quotes all over the place talking about how it will be impossible for Google to even catalog merely a small percentage of the world's literary works. So there are an awful lot of questions that get raised as to what the realistic impact is of all of this, or should it be viewed in the same sort of light as we've seen the Sony decisions, we've seen Grokster, and we've seen a number of the other technology-based copyright-related decisions. With that and the notion of keeping the business models in mind, why don't I turn things over to Professor Fleming to talk to you a little bit about the technology, and while you do that, I'll fire it up and we can actually take a look online as you're talking.
Great. Well, what's impressive about what Google has done is not the technology of it, because the technology of it is pretty simple. You probably already know this. We use it in our practice. I'm a litigator. If I have a book in front of me, I scan the book. You have to find a way to do that efficiently, because it takes a lot of time to scan a book. Usually those are done by shipping the books overseas. There are cameras that take a picture of two pages open at once, take the images of those pages, put them into a machine that reads the pages and translates them into searchable text. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it, and I'm actually a person who's taken advantage of this, is to send Google a PDF, an actual original PDF of your work. Years ago, a few partners of mine and I published a book, and we created, it was not as much fun to publish the book or write the book as it was to actually generate the camera-ready art, so to speak, for the publisher. So we had the thing put into a book format, generated a PDF, shipped it off to a printer, and got it done for about $1.70 a book, including a four-color cover, which I thought was pretty impressive. And so we had this PDF sitting around here, and I saw Google print one day and thought, this would be fun. So I shipped them my PDF, and they put it online. That PDF being generated from a computer file originally still had the words in it, so Google's search engine could take those words and crunch them. And then what happens is Google takes all those words, creates, in effect, a massive index. And if you ever want to have some fun sometime, look up how Google builds the index with all the machines. But it indexes those books like it indexes web pages and lets you search for the books. What you get sort of depends on what Google wants to do with it. But if you search for books, you'll see part of a page or all of a page in some cases of any of these books. Our book comes up just like anybody else's book. That's generally speaking how it works. There are a lot of different things you can do, but that's the bottom line in the technology. You could do this tomorrow if you wanted to and you had a lot of time. It's not that difficult to do. What's impressive about what Google did is the chutzpah of going out and scanning every, or wanting to scan every book that's out there, with the threat of the kind of sanctions that Jed Rakoff imposed on MP3.com. $25,000 a hit. Now, I can tell you that most books being sold today aspire to make half that much money or even less. You don't get rich publishing books, so who knows what the sanction would be for those. But books, Leslie said something to start out with, which is most authors write books because they want the books to be read. I think probably most authors write books because they want the books to be sold, and they don't particularly care whether you read them. I'll end with that.
My next.
I believe that was the order that we sort of flipped.
Okay,
the coins
good,
in.
Good. Well, I'm here to talk about the law, and in particular, copyright law and fair use doctrine, how it applies to the case. And so, I won't talk a lot about technology, other than just to kind of observe the fact of how interesting it is. Just a little bit over 20 years ago, The main issue before the Supreme Court in the Sony, the Betamax case, was whether or not you could record a program on your VCR. 20 years later, now we have an enormous amount of processing power in computers, a lot of storage and memory, and what I would call algorithmic excellence on behalf of Google. It's interesting just to observe, kind of as a framework for all this, where we are technologically and how this is just merely, in a certain sense, can be seen as nothing more than a recent episode of the perennial tension between new technologies and the laws that could be enforced to constrain them. So, you know, what is Google Book Search? You know, we've heard a little bit about this, and I'll just address perhaps maybe the ambition behind the project. As you've heard, the goal really of that Google has on this is to make every word of every book ever written searchable from your desktop, and it's quite an ambitious project. Something like scanning and indexing 20 million books, I believe, something like that. So, in particular, what's caused the most controversy is the Google Library project. There are two portions. I won't really talk about the publisher, the Google Publisher program, because really there aren't a whole lot of issues there. This is, all the scanning of the books is done with the agreement of the publishers. Where the most controversy arises is in the Google Library project, and in particular with the lawsuits that have been filed in the Southern District of New York, the controversy that has arisen over the scanning the works in the University of Michigan Library. It's the way that William Patry described it on his blog is they've Google has taken to scanning books, copyright be damned, and that is a bit of hyperbole, but it is essentially what Google has done. They've gone to worked with these libraries to scan these works and index them. There was a hiatus for a few months until the beginning of November where Google allowed publishers to opt out if they didn't want their works, or copyright owners to opt out if they didn't want their work scanned. But what Google does with these is makes some bibliographic information available when you do a search. The full text of public domain works are available, and for with the permission of the copyright owners, full page views of books can be made available for browsing just a few pages at a time. And then for copyrighted works, if permission from the copyright owner can't be acquired, they just do snippets, which is just, you know, a few words on either side of the search terms that appear. There have been two lawsuits filed, and the first one was filed by the Authors Guild on September 20th on behalf of its members. They're seeking class certification. It's in the Southern District of New York. It's also on behalf of a few individual authors. And then another lawsuit was filed on October 19th by the American Association of Publishers as an associational plaintiff on behalf of some of their members, including McGraw-Hill, Simon & Schuster, John Wiley & Sons, and others. And the basic position is that taking these works without permission, without getting permission first, is just nothing more than massive copyright infringement. That's the word that's been used in the complaint, in at least one of the complaints. Google's position is essentially, and really the most important legal issue boils down to this, is that this is fair use. And it's the way the web works. Professor Reese alluded to it in her remarks. Caching pages, indexing pages stored on a server is just the way Google and how other search engines work. Just as one can put a tag in one's HTML to preclude or to disallow robots from crawling the web, publishers can opt out of this, at least ostensibly. In the first lawsuit, just for a little bit on the procedural posture of these cases, in the first lawsuit, the one filed in September, Google is going to be moving for summary judgment, and these issues of fair use, I'm sure, are swirling around very fervently in the minds of Google's attorneys right now. Their summary judgment brief is due tomorrow, so we'll have a little bit more to read by that. In the second lawsuit, they have answered the complaint, and I don't really know what the strategy, I would open that up to anybody on the panel or to any of you, why they might be doing that. I think maybe they're wanting to just dispense with the first case, maybe argue collateral estoppel in the second case. I just don't know. But in any event, we'll be getting a summary judgment brief by Google, and the briefing schedule set by the court says that it'll be filed no later than tomorrow. So, as I said, the central issue is fair use, and what I'd like to spend the remainder of my time here doing is just talking about the fair use factors, and in particular, talking about the case that Google says it's going to rely on. Whether or not they'll be able to rely on it to much with much strength is yet to be seen. It's a Ninth Circuit case of Kelly versus Ariba. But let's just run through the fair use factors, which are set out in Section 107 of the Copyright Act. First of all, fair use is not an infringement. That's the language of the statute. But instead, it's an affirmative defense. And the defendant in a copyright action has the burden of proof of showing that a particular use is fair. Just as a little more background here, before the 1976 Copyright Act, fair use was exclusively a judge-made doctrine. And doing a little bit of reading on the case here, or a little bit of research before the talk here today, came across the 1841 case of Folsom against Marsh. And I believe this was cited in the well-known Campbell case, the Two Live Crew case. I'm sure most of you are at least somewhat familiar with that. But let me just read a quote of Justice Story's from 1841, and think of it in your minds as applying this test to something, you know, over a century and a half later here. To find whether a use is fair, Justice Story says, look to the nature and objects of the selections made, the quantity and value of the materials used, and the degree in which the use may prejudice the sale or diminish the profits or supersede the objects of the original work. That's a pretty good articulation of the fair use test. It's been codified in Section 107. But even with these factors that are in 107, which we'll cover here, it's hard to draw a bright line because, you know, case law from the Second Circuit, where the Google cases will be heard, says it always depends on the consideration of the precise facts at hand. So it's just by definition kind of tricky to read the tea leaves on whether a particular use is fair. But anyway, four factors. The first factor is to look at the purpose and character of the work. And in this context, whether the work is commercial is important. But just because a use being made of a work is commercial doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be a fair use. We learned this from the Two Live Crew case that I was talking about. Commercial use weighs against the finding of fair use, but it's not conclusive on the issue. Something that's even more important probably in this case, in the Google case, is going to be whether or not the use being made of a work is transformative. And this is a relatively new term to articulate the fair use test, or this element of the fair use test, but we look to see whether a work replaces the object of the original creation and instead adds a further purpose or different character, you know, taking very strongly from what Justice Story said in 1841. The second factor looks to the nature of the copyrighted work, and this I don't believe is important in the Google case, all that important. These are non-exclusive factors, so the court may or may not even consider all these. Creative works are generally are closer to the core of intended copyright protection. So a use made of a creative work is less likely to be considered a fair use. The third factor is the amount and substantiality of the portion used. Now this is an important one for the Google case because Google is scanning the entire work. And the case law has said that using the entire work militates against a finding of fair use. This comes from the Ninth Circuit in the Hustler versus Moral Majority case. But in any event, or on the contrary, just like a commercial use doesn't automatically make something not a fair use, a use of an entire work doesn't mean that it can't be fair use. Take, for example, the Betamax case, again, the Sony case from 1984. Most people think of that as being a case that dealt with secondary infringement liability. If you're interested in the Grokster case, everybody's thinking about Sony. But one thing that's often overlooked is that case also dealt with fair use, and the Supreme Court held that it was fair use to tape with your VCR an entire episode. The fourth factor, which will be an important factor in the Google case, is the effect on the potential market for the copyrighted work. And in fact, going back to the Sony case again, if the intended use is for commercial gain, the likelihood of market harm may be presumed. So, taking those four fair use factors, Google has said that it will rely heavily on the Ninth Circuit case from 2003 called Kelly versus Ariba Soft, which has facts that are very similar to this. Ariba, which is now known as Ditto.com, it created a search engine for images, and it compiled the database by crawling the web and making low-resolution thumbnails. And users of Ditto.com would search, and they were given the thumbnails, and they could click on the thumbnail and go to the original website. But really what was happening here was Ariba was taking the original work in its entirety, making a copy of it, a low-resolution thumbnail. But in any event, it was taking the whole work, and a photographer by the name of Les Kelly noticed that some of his works, his photos, were appearing on that, and filed a lawsuit against Ariba I think it was the Central District of California. He moved for summary judgment. Well, actually, the parties moved for summary judgment. And the court found that it was indeed fair use to use these images in this way, taking the entire works, making them small, low resolution, for the purpose of leading a user of the internet to another site where the original works appeared. The district court granted summary judgment in Ariba's favor, finding fair use, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that opinion. So looking at the fair use factors in the context of Kelly, there really was no commercial, the question that it was commercial in nature, but the court noted that its use was of the thumbnail images was more incidental and less exploitative in nature than more traditional types of fair use. They weren't really, they certainly weren't selling copies of these thumbnail images. You know, it would be, if you've ever done any digital image editing, you know, if you enlarge a low resolution small image and try to print it out, it's going to look bad. So they weren't trying to do that, so it wasn't commercial in that sense. And I think that the comparison we could make here in the Google book search case is that, yes, Google book search is commercial, but they are clearly not going to be in the business of selling or even providing full text of copyrighted works. There's just going to be either snippets or just a few pages on either side of the search term with the copyright owner's permission. In the Kelly case, the court held that it was indeed transformative. The low-resolution images were for an entirely different purpose than what the photographer had intended them to be. The court talked aspirationally in this. You know, they were meant to engage the viewer in an aesthetic experience. You know, you look at this picture of the American West that the photographer had taken. You know, that's not what Kelly was doing by putting these little thumbnail images. One irony I find here, and I know that we're short on time, and I don't want to get off topic at all, but one irony here is that the Kelly, the plaintiff in the case, was a photographer of among other subject matter, the Amish. So isn't it funny to think about, you know, Amish and their zero technology, you know, and the facts of a case arising from those facts would have anything to do with something that's so avant-garde as the Google Print case. So looking to the nature of the copyrighted work in Kelly, they were indeed creative works, and this factor did indeed weigh in favor of the plaintiff. On the third factor, the amount and substantiality of the work copied, this factor weighed in favor of neither party. It was the court held that it was necessary to copy the entire image so that it would be so that, that what Kelly was trying to do would be able to be done. And in comparison with Google Book Search, if Google does what it wants to do, it really wouldn't make any sense to scan just partial texts because it wouldn't allow for the results. So it's likely that this factor might weigh in favor of Google. On the final factor, the effect on the potential market, the court held that this weighed in favor of Ariba. The search engine would in fact allow more people to see the plaintiff's photographs than if the search engine didn't exist at all. This is the same argument that Google is making. You know, there are all these books that are languishing away in the libraries that are in darkness and they're collecting dust and everything else. Google, what they're doing is so gallantly, is making it available. You can learn about this book. Just go right over here, click on the link to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, and you'll see they'll be selling books that you wouldn't know about otherwise. I think that one needs to be a little bit cautious in thinking about this argument so much, because the real concern of the publishers, if you read the complaint, particularly if you want to look at the American Association of Publishers complaint in paragraph 35, they articulate their concern very well, They're concerned about the market for digital archival copies of the work. They're not worried about whether or not it's going to sell, they're going to sell more books or not. In fact, you know, I think in so many ways they've admitted that it might indeed help their bottom line, sell more books. But we don't know where technology is going to go. It's likely that there will be devices that make it easier to read digital copies in the next 10, 20 years. You know, I mean, it's easier to read now on a nice flat panel monitor than what it was with an old cathode ray tube monitor just 5 years ago. So there may be a market for these digital archival copies. And that's something that I believe that even though the Kelly case sounds really good when you're arguing on behalf of Google, there is a very legitimate concern there on the part of the copyright owners that we need to take seriously. And with that, I'll stop talking about the legal issues. Nothing like getting our lawyers there talking. love to hear themselves talk. So.
By the way, anybody want to buy a book?
Am I next?
Yes, unless we want to do a pitch to sell Professor Plimer's book.
It's free, so if you want a copy, just give me a call.
All right. Well, I'm going to focus on the permission default choice aspect of the Google Print, Google Book Search situation. And I'm going to make some assumptions, perhaps not entirely accurate, about how it works and what Google's up to. There's a few different activities that Google's involved in. Number one, they're scanning the works, which includes, as Todd mentioned, includes making an image of the work and then performing character recognition to convert that into actual text that can then be used in other ways. So there's the scanning process. There's the indexing process, which is where you construct some kind of list of which words appear where, a concordance of sorts. And I'm not going to really dwell on that because it seems fairly clear to me that if all you're doing is indexing, you don't have to worry too much about copyright. Shepherd's citations, indexes, citations with pinpoint citations. West Group, which has asserted a right to pinpoint citations, has never really raised a question about whether Shepherds can use pinpoint cites or whether Lexis in publishing complete copies of the public domain works with West's page numbers was more of a concern. But the transformative indexing is not really a concern. And then, of course, the other thing, the sort of the killer application of Google Book Search is the display providing access to the works. That's why people were so excited when Google came out with Google Print, which lets you print out books. And of course it doesn't, which is why they renamed it. But the two major activities that we're talking about are scanning and displaying. There are three major groups of works involved here. One of them is works for which publishers have consented to have Google scan and display, at least to some extent. Those are the works in the Google Publisher project. And since those all have involved permission from publishers, there really isn't an issue with those. The second group is works for which the publisher has explicitly opted out, has told Google, we don't want you indexing this stuff. As I understand it, there's a couple of ways a publisher can do that. They can sign up for the Google Publisher program and then say, here's a list of works we don't want you to use. Or they can simply submit a notice to Google saying, we own these works and we don't want you to use them. I'm going to make the assumption, I don't know whether it's entirely accurate or not, I'm going to make the assumption that Google will completely respect publishers' preferences for publishers who explicitly opt out. That is, they not only won't they provide access, they won't scan the stuff in the first place. If they've scanned it and a publisher objects, they'll delete all records of it. I don't know whether that's entirely true, but let's assume that for now. The third group, I think, is the most interesting. The third group is the works for which publishers don't do anything, either because they've never heard of Google or because the publisher doesn't really exist in any viable form anymore, sort of publishers of orphan works, out-of-print works, maybe works that aren't really economically feasible anymore. Those, of course, are the ones that I would assume libraries are the most interested in having scanned, because those are the hardest to track down otherwise. But I think this Say Nothing group, where publishers aren't opting in and aren't opting out, aren't objecting, also includes some works for which, for whatever reason, the publishers aren't prepared yet to say, you can copy this stuff or don't copy this stuff. Publishers simply aren't doing anything. Now, assuming and I think it's a reasonable assumption, assuming that there are a significant number of commercial works in this category, the interesting question for copyright law purposes is how much can Google do with those works? A publisher knows that Google's planning to scan the stuff and provide very limited access to it through Google Book Search. Publisher chooses not to do anything about that. Can the publisher then later sue Google and say, you're infringing on our copyright, here's our damages from this, and we want an injunction to stop you from doing it in the future? I don't know the answer to that question. I merely raise it as what I think is perhaps the most interesting issue within the Google print situation. To divide it up among the two tasks, the scanning and the display of the works that Google's doing, I think we probably would be well advised to focus mostly on the scanning function. Google could always change how much they're displaying of the work in the future without entirely defeating the purpose of the project. The amount of works that they're displaying on the screen in the library project is quite minimal at this point, and certainly they would have a fairly strong argument that the amount is so small it qualifies for fair use because of the extent of the work. The scanning, of course, involves the entire work, so that's going to be a more difficult argument. One question I think that's raised by that is, what exactly does scanning and storing mean? Is it equivalent to, is it analogous to simply reading a work and remembering it? It's not equivalent, obviously, but it's probably more like that than it's like republishing multiple copies of the work. Under copyright law, it probably qualifies as making a duplicate of a work, copying a work, which is within the exclusive rights of the copyright holder. So I'm not suggesting that it's not infringement, but for a possible fair use defense. But I think that's a question worth considering. Before I close, I want to compare this, what Google's doing, to what Google has done before, to the Google web search spider, the Googlebot. What the Googlebot does when it goes out to gather web pages for the Google web search engine is, and the Googlebot is a robot, a computer process, it sends hypertext transfer protocol requests to websites to find out what files are on the website, on a web server. The Googlebot goes to a website and looks for a sign that says, robots go away. Or maybe a more specific sign saying, robots, you can come here, but don't keep copies of our site, don't archive it. If there's a sign like that, the Googlebot respects the sign, just like a door-to-door salesperson would respect a sign that says no solicitors on the doorstep of your house, or might not, or you might have a local ordinance and get to the Supreme Court on that. But the Googlebot, at least, is fairly polite in that sense. It will respect any signs telling it to go away. It then identifies itself, or it identifies itself with each transaction. In particular, when it requests copies of the file, of each of the files, of each of the web pages from the server, it says, I'm the Googlebot, I'd like a copy of this file. The web server may choose to respond by giving the Googlebot a copy of the file, which is what usually happens. It may choose to respond by giving a special version of the file that it wants indexed by Google, which isn't the version that everybody else sees. Now, Google doesn't like that, and one thing it'll do is stop indexing the site if that happens. Or it may simply refuse to serve up the file, saying, we don't like search engines gathering and spidering our site, and so we're not going to give you a copy of it, even though we didn't bother posting a no robot sign. If the search engine, if the web server does choose to give a copy of its files to the Googlebot when the Googlebot stops by, Google will then hold on to a copy of the file, index it so that it can be retrieved through the Google search engine. If somebody does a search on Google that retrieves the page, it'll list it in the search results. It'll link to the page, and what Google does in some other search engines, it will actually also serve up archived copies of the site if it happens to have them ready. And that raises probably some more copyright questions. But again, the Googlebot is so polite about letting content owners opt out of that that there haven't been a whole lot of objections. The Google Book Search or Google Print process is very similar to that. It's not quite as polite. But I'd like to suggest that I think the aspects in which the Google Book Search engine is not as polite as the Googlebot are related more to limitations of the technology. When Google scans a book in its library project, if there's a notice in the book that says, don't scan this into your library project, I'm going to assume that Google will treat that as an opt-out notice and not do it. I don't think that's clear, and certainly there are pretty blanket statements in most copyrighted works saying, imposing restrictions that would include scanning. So arguably, it may be a vague opt-out, but there is an opt-out appearing in the copyright notice in most works. The Google search engine does not identify itself while it's scanning the work because there's nobody to tell. I suppose you could tell the scanning computer, I'm scanning this to put it in Google Book Search, but that message isn't likely to get back to the publisher in the same way that the Googlebot's statement that I'm the Googlebot is going to get to the web server operator. But at least in some sense, Google Book Search or Google Print is respecting opt-out notices in roughly the same way that the Googlebot is for the search engine. And if we say, as a matter of copyright law, the failure of a publisher, of a copyright holder, to object in the context of a web search, I'm sorry, in the context of Google Print, the failure to object is irrelevant, you need explicit affirmative consent, I think it's likely we'd want to reach the same conclusion in the case of web search engines. So to say that Google Print can't scan books isn't that far from saying a search engine ought not be able to index the web without permission from each website operator. It's not exactly the same, but I think those are close questions. I will move on from there. I think I've probably raised more questions than I've answered, but maybe we'll have time to talk about them.
We all have, I'm sure. Can talk for a second about the impact that the Google Print Library Project may have on traditional libraries and information retrieval in general. How many of you took my internet legal research class as part of LS 2? Some? Okay. If you remember in that class, I talked about what I call the horns of the internet research dilemma, and to sort of tie this back in, I think it's very true here. On the one hand, to me, a lot of people believe that everything is available on the internet and you should just be able to go out and find it for free. On the other hand, even if that were true, most people, in my opinion, lack the necessary information retrieval skills to actually go out and find it. And to me, this project lies right at the heart of that quandary. On the one hand, you have the interesting situation where if you look at this debate, you will find out that, in my opinion, many, many authors, publishers, and librarians don't exactly understand what the Google Print Library Project entails. And I think it's important to take a step back in terms of looking at the access that you'll have to this information and understand that. We talk about full access to public domain works. What that really means is things prior to 1923. Things after 1923 that are copyrighted, you are only going to have very, very limited, you will have access to search, but in terms of retrieving and using that information, you're going to have very, you're only going to have a snippet or keywords in context view. Unless the authors have chosen otherwise, which to me is going to be a very small percentage, at least for now. One of the other interesting things with this is that librarians themselves hold very divergent views as to what the effect is going to be, positive or negative. So let me just sort of summarize those views. On the one hand, there are people who view this, librarians who view this very positively, that traditional libraries should look and act more like Google. I'll call these people the hipsters. They believe that digitizing what is presently print-only resources can only be good. It increases the store of knowledge that's generally accessible by the public. And they see this, many people see this as sort of analogous. Google is doing for public libraries or for libraries what Amazon.com did for book buying, in that providing limited access ought to spur business for libraries when people realize, I can't get all of this here, I need to go somewhere else. That sort of rests on the assumption that the libraries themselves take care of, take advantage of the marketing opportunities that they are being provided. Again, to sort of draw this home to the, what I was hoping more of you would see in my presentation, I showed the example that Westlaw, for example, now owns its own internet search, its internet portal called findlaw.com. And the reason, in my view, that Westlaw owns findlaw.com is because West is very happy to provide you with all the legal information that's freely available on the internet. And when you don't find what you're looking for, because you're only looking at a fraction of the information that actually is available, and it is mostly outdated, they're happy to link you to their site where you can put down your credit card and get more. And I think the Google Print Library Project, in terms of effect, would be very much the same way. The negative view, the negative side, who I will call the Bunsters, view Google with suspicion because Google as a search engine lacks the hallmarks of an effective information retrieval system, namely recall, which is the ability to gather all relevant information, and precision, which is the ability to gather only relevant information. We talked a little bit about indexing, and one of the things that you don't realize, at least now, my understanding, is Google's not going to provide you the basic access points that a library catalog will. Author, title, subject. You can't get those. You're searching essentially by keyword. Maybe that'll change, but that's my understanding at this point. One of the also things that you're going to see in terms of access, and those of you who may become teachers or parents will find this out when your kids start copying papers, is loss of context. Because even though you can get a few sentences around something that you get on Google, if you decide to use that, you're losing, you don't have any of the context in which that information was produced. There is what we call, Carl Llewellyn called the threat of the available, also is known as satisficing in the marketing world, which is basically this concept that people tend to gravitate toward what is easiest and what is most efficient. And understanding that the Google Print Library Project is going to make available for full consumption and full access a number of works from 1923 and before that weren't publicly available. One of the things that I predict is you're going to start to see a lot of high school history papers and maybe college papers and, God forbid, law school papers using information from 1923 and before, because it's easier to get at and people don't check their sources. So, in my view, the Google Print Library Project adds another layer of complexity to the research process. This growing complexity increases the need for informational professionals to assist researchers in working their way through the very often unsystematic forest of information-bearing resources. Ultimately, I think the marriage of valuable library content and all-purpose search engines could be a win-win situation. But I think, sadly, I think that there will not be enough resources marshaled to take advantage of the potential benefits, and ultimately the outcome, in my opinion, will be negative, not only but for libraries, but for research as a whole. There needs to be a balance between integrating library resources into Google and educating users to understand that they sometimes need to be where the library is. Unfortunately, this balance is being struck between the Google camp, which has unlimited resources and financial incentive to provide incentives, and librarians who have very limited resources to cope with and take advantage of the inevitable changes. So, in a nutshell, that's my perspective.
We have a limited amount of time. I was going to ask a bunch of questions, but I think the best thing to do now is you've heard a lot of different views, a lot of different ideas, and just start and throw it open. Anybody have any comments or questions they would like to make in the short amount of time? Because if not, I got a bunch of them.
We were afraid of her questions, which is why we went long.
Mm-hmm. That's why they're hoping.
So please jump in.
Let me just leap in. I think one of the things that's very interesting about, it's very hard to stand up and say, I am opposed to, not the book print search, because they actually get permission from the publishers to do it. It's the library project, where, at least according to the complaint, there's a couple of interesting things that are going on. One, notice you have to opt out. Hi, I'm going to infringe your copyright unless you tell me not to. Whoa. That's a major change. Second, one of the things that the publishers are claiming in the complaint and the reason that Michigan is the source of it is Google didn't just copy the text so they were available for searching whether you wanted them to or not. Google also agreed to provide to the Michigan Library one digital copy of every book we copy from your collection. Now, whether you're entitled to that digital copy or not, whether the publishers are willing to sell you a digital copy or not, whether that even solves some of the archiving problem, because as we know, anybody still have files on the old 8-inch floppy disks? Ever tried to read one of those? You can't get the technology anymore. The reality is the copying is a copy plus. That's part of the project. That's how they got the universities to agree. Harvard and Oxford are also part of the process, although they have backed out. So my question is, do I have an absolute right to have access to information on the internet such that searching should be a fair use? Whatever you need to allow me to search should be allowed.
You want me to answer that?
Anybody who wants to. That's my question.
Here's the issue with copyright law is not whether there's an absolute right in a vacuum to do anything. Okay. Copyright law is ultimately serving a master. And the master is the promotion of what we would roughly describe as the arts and the sciences. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the right balance and mix of laws and regimes that will promote the most material. Now, I can tell you that in the book publishing arena, there's a lot of publishing that goes on without any expectation of profit. I think 180,000 new books last year. In fact, that may even be the number of publishers, because small publishers publish now. There's a huge amount of material coming out, and the hardest part about the material is that you can't find anything. Now, putting aside some of the more complex aspects of searching, which is left to a professional like a librarian, just finding information is tough, and there's too much information. So it's not a question of whether there's an absolute right or not, from my perspective. The fair use doctrine says it's kind of like an unwelcome easement. You know, you can have land in our city, but as part of the right to have the land, there are certain things you can't do, like run an oil factory, although I'm working on that, and you have to let us drive our trucks and utility vehicles over your land. This is kind of the same thing. You get the protection of the law for your work, but at the same time, you have to let this sort of public easement go over your work. And if this falls within the vague and difficult to define fair use doctrine, or difficult to apply fair use doctrine, then this is in effect something that the publishers have to accept, whether they like it or not.
Should I take that in a little bit different direction, in that a lot of the anti-comments that I've heard regarding this particular instance relates to the necessity for the publishers to actually assert their rights proactively, which sort of flip-flops the traditional methods of how authors have gone about asserting their rights.
Well, think about privacy.
Well, exactly. And
check the box if you don't want us to tell all your private information.
One of the issues that comes to mind is, as a creator of a website, does that mean I necessarily have to proactively assert my rights at the onset of creation? In other words, those rights are not necessarily fixed unless I say, hello bots, don't copy my site. On the other side of that, and being a not-so-technologically expert human being, I know just enough to know that I'm putting information out there that I want people to see. I'm not going to make any money off of LeslieRees.com. I'm perhaps promoting some classes, and I sure like the vast majority of the world to see what we do here at John Marshall. I want that information found. So in essentially setting up how I want my rights to be protected, I'm putting that into the calculus right from the get-go, right from the front end. Does that necessarily sort of change the model of creation?
Well, I think there's a difference, because one of the things that I think is really interesting about all these books, they're not on websites right now. This isn't somebody who chose to be on the internet and impliedly agreed some of this stuff you guys are going to be able to search, and unless I put that language in, I'm screwed. These are books sitting on a shelf. Let me just ask, how many people have been to the library recently to look at a book? You know, that's the scary thing.
I actually found one in Google Book Search, and I had to go to the library to get it.
There you go. I think now, how many people have read an e-book, an electronic book? See, it's interesting. The same number that went to the library are willing to read the e-books.
I think
what's interesting is, because people have said, and one of the arguments has been, we don't have to worry about this because nobody's going to read the text of an entire book off the screen. For my generation, that's true. I'm sorry, I'm paper trained. You know, I go out, and even when they have the free books, I go out and buy the damn copy of the book. But I don't think that's necessarily true. And I think with the catching that you can do, how many people have done a Google search and you go to the archive site because it loads faster? okay? An archive site can very well have the entire text of the book, which is printable. So there's more going on here than just a card catalog, because God knows, at least in the card catalog, I assume that's the books that are in the library. And they give you the basic information so you can go find it. What do you think they're going to do with Kelly versus Reba?
Well, it's Kelly case is Ninth Circuit. This case, I'm going to say when it goes on appeal, we'll go up to the Second Circuit. And, you know, you mentioned the UMG versus MP3.com case. You know, that's pretty harsh against fair use. I mean, if it, this hasn't been assigned to Judge Rakoff. It's assigned to Judge Spritzo. But, you know, I mean, it's not by any means clear-cut in the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit, I don't think you can say, is necessarily all that friendly to fair use. Certainly not as friendly as the Ninth Circuit would have been. There's a reason why they didn't file it in Central District of California.
Yes?
I just wonder if anyone knows whether the publishers in the publisher's lawsuit have opted out of Google.
You know, they didn't make that statement in the complaint.
I would assume it includes some who didn't.
They might not even have standing to sue if they opted out.
It probably includes some who did and some who didn't. You know, and it strikes me that one of the objections that publishers have is they don't want other publishers' stuff in Google Book Search. Because if it has a lot of stuff and everybody's stuff but theirs, then there's less access to their works, and suddenly they've got to worry about competition from publishers whose stuff is available online when they didn't before.
But see, the book search, there's a difference between the book search and the library, because I think the book search is fine, because the publishers have agreed to do that. They've said, fine, put it in. And we may end up with everybody eventually agreeing for marketing reasons in that. But the idea is, it's between the things where you get to do it and your parents said you had to do it. And I think that's part of the problem here is I'm not even getting to raise my hand. And I'll be honest, I have a book that's in Michigan, Harvard, and Oxford, and I haven't opted in or out yet because I can't figure out what I want to do, and I actually do own the copyright in it.
Well, the allegations of the complaint say that these works have been scanned and or will be scanned. I mean, I think the real thing that's upsetting the copyright owners the most is the scanning, not necessarily the redistribution, the thing that they could opt out of. So I think whether they'd opted out would probably not be relevant on the standing, because they've alleged that they either have been scanned or will be scanned.
Yeah.
There was a question.
Was there a question? Oops, hiding back there.
Yeah. One comment, one question. Actually, it's funny because some of the people in the Association of American Publishers suit are in the partner program and agreed to give their books over, but they're still suing their library program. I would wonder what the panel thought of the piracy argument. It's not in either of the complaints, but it's certainly been raised a lot in statements in the press and on the websites and the Authors Guild and the AAP that this is this is the nationalization of books, is how one put it. Is that argument, do you think that argument is going to make it into these cases and will Grokster come in because of that argument?
Are you talking about the risk that a hacker is going to get access to these works and then redistribute them?
Yeah, somebody will break into Google server farm or figure out a way to
I mean, it's just all this infringement of printed works is so rampant on Grokster. I mean, gosh, there were just millions of copies of Shakespeare distributed over Grokster. Sarcasm here. Sarcasm tag.
Well,
it's
second to the Britney Spears album, but I know what you're saying.
Right.
Enough, so.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there is sort of an interesting, if I were a publisher, one of the reasons I'd probably be afraid is that right now, it doesn't look so harmless. You know, they take your book out of the library, they scan it, you get a little snippet. I actually searched for my name in a book to see if I could find my book. Found another person citing me, and I really wanted to read the rest of it, but then it was cut off. Right now, it's such a small snippet that you know, it's not that big of a deal. So next year, after they get past the first case, it's this much, and then the year after, it's this much, and the amount increases. And eventually, we all become so used to it that, in effect, it's like giving a BlackBerry to everybody in Congress, you know? You know you're probably going to be safe because the system's just going to accept you and you'll become part of the norm. And I think to some extent the publishers are worried about that. This is not going to harm authors if that comes to this, because she could obviously publish her book using my technology for free tomorrow, but she chooses to turn over a ton of her profits to these large publishers. The publishers, on the other hand, say, wait a minute, you know, where's the middleman anymore? How come we can't make money off of people? And they're in the same position as the record companies.
just remember that the business model is evolutionary, and that we shouldn't, at least at this stage, vilify Google for pushing the envelope for creating new ways to use the technology in ways that might just happen to make money for people.
Except Google's making the money on it right now. Has anybody ever seen what their profit and loss statement is right now? Oh man, I want stuck in that one. Any other questions or comments? I'd like to thank our panel and thank the audience for coming.